Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing education and training for all UK registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and a final examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists.
Keratoconus is often starting in childhood, before the age of 10 even in some cases.
That was Damien Lake, consultant ophthalmologist and surgeon at East Grinstead Hospital. Keratoconus is a corneal dystrophy, where a progressive thinning of the cornea causes it to bulge, resulting in an abnormal cone shape. It is still the most frequent reason for keratoplasty, and if left unchecked, one in five patients will eventually need a corneal transplant. Keratoconus, although serious, is a chronic condition that only requires a routine referral. But against the backdrop of COVID-19 and the restrictions that were imposed, there is now a backlog of routine ophthalmology referrals waiting to be seen. And I'm wondering, is there anything we should be doing in the meantime to follow up these patients ourselves? But first, let's hear about one patient whose keratoconus was so advanced that he has had to have several cross-linking treatments and is only now just recovering from his second corneal transplant. Our producer, Dr. Hilary Guyte, started by asking him how he was first diagnosed.
I went to the opticians because my vision started getting a lot worse with my glasses. And one thing which I think was a good early indication was in my bedroom, I had a television with a little standby light on it, like a little red light. And I noticed that the light was changing. And that was one of the questions that I was asked at the opticians was, you know, how do you see a light? Is it sort of halos and lots of different lights and all these things?
So how old were you at the time you got the diagnosis of keratoconus?
I remember it was a few days before my 17th birthday.
And you're how old now?
25. So it's been about 8 years.
And had you been having regular eye examinations from an early age before that time?
I just went to a normal high street opticians and went probably once every year or once every 2 years, something like that. But I kept having to go back before the recommended recall period.
Did you have hay fever at the time? Were you rubbing your eyes?
That is one of the questions that they asked me at the time. And no, I don't have hay fever. I've never had hay fever. Never been allergic to anything. But rubbing my eyes, I don't think so, not particularly.
Does anyone else in your family have keratoconus?
Yeah, actually, yeah. My cousin on my dad's side. His was picked up quite soon and he had cross-linking just in the one eye and he's sort of fine now.
So his experience was quite different to yours.
Yes, yes.
Can we go through some of the treatments you've had? So after seeing a consultant, you were sent to have specialist lenses fitted, is that right?
Yeah, I had mini scleral hard contact lenses fitted. At first, it used to take me, you know, a really, really long time to get those lenses in, sort of close to an hour. So I'd have to get up really early before school and just figure out how to do it because I was really uncomfortable doing it. But since then, I've learned. And you adapt to those sort of things.
You were also given a referral to a specialist.
Yeah, I was. I had my first cross-linking, which I've had four of, two in each eye over the years. There was a bit of a tricky thing there. It would have been sooner. He had the availability. We were ready to go, but I had my exams and he talked about what the recovery meant and how difficult it would be and the problems with the eye afterwards. So we sort of decided to just wait a short amount of time until after I'd done a few exams.
So you had four cross-linkings?
Yeah, and I'm given to understand that that's very unusual. I had the first two, and the way that my consultant explained it to me was, he said, it's like trying to stop a glacier, you know, like we can do this and it should slow down the progression. But he sort of indicated that it probably hadn't slowed it enough or stopped it completely. And I was about to go to university. He said, you should get a transplant, but we sort of discussed it and we eventually decided to have the cross-linkings again. I'm 25 now and I've just had my second transplant, so there hasn't been much of a break in the past sort of 7 or 8 years with that.
How's your mental health held up?
When it first happened, I think I probably didn't appreciate the magnitude of what it meant. So I was probably naive enough not to let it affect me. But the older I've gotten, the more I've sort of realised that it has a greater effect than you think.
Yeah. So you've had keratoconus since being at school. What impact do you think that's had on your choice of career and your education?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I think it came at a bad time. I guess it's had a massive impact. It was right at my A-levels, so it affected my studies, and I think it definitely affected where I went to university. Well, I know it did. At my school, there was an Oxbridge pool. They did sort of extra stuff, and I was in that. And then when this happened, they sort of took me aside and said, well, you should probably not do that because you've got enough going on.
This patient did not want us to use his name, so we'll refer to him as Jay. His story is a powerful one. It reminds us of not just the visual consequences of late diagnosis, but the potential emotional impact as well. And it emphasises the important role of community optometrists in detecting keratoconus early. Joining me now is Yahia Varley. He's a community optometrist in Leicester who also works in a hospital corneal service, dealing with referrals for keratoconus and other corneal conditions. Here, were the signs described by Jay typical of someone with keratoconus?
In the case of the patient in the case study, you have an excellent description of how he noticed his vision. And it's quite often a good idea to ask patients to describe themselves, how they find their eyesight. Do they know a difference between the two eyes covering each eye? Can they tell? And most patients have usually tried that out themselves, where they will check each eye separately and they will see a difference.
Mm. You know, with the light you hear, do they tend to see more coma?
Yeah, so a spot turns slightly elongated.
So a good way of a patient to describe it, instead of looking like a spot, it looks more like a comet.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else in their history that's important apart from their symptoms?
Yeah, you want to probe on family history. If there is keratoconus in the family, that's one of the things you need to be thinking about. The history of atopy, so asthma, eczema, hay fever, that's high risk with regards to keratoconus. But then also you want to ask them about whether they rub their eyes, because that is a high risk for developing changes, particularly in keratoconics.
Mm. So having done history and symptoms, and you start to go through sort of the clinical examination part, can you talk me through what you would do?
Yeah, the first thing I would do is do a retinoscopy over their existing glasses. And quite often you will see that there is more sill than was previously prescribed, and that's quite easy to pick up. When you do your refraction, you see a reduction in the myopic element or an increase in the hyperopic element, coupled with the change in the sill, and that should ring alarm bells for you. The other thing you'll find is you cannot get the VA to the same level as previously.
So if you did see a slight reduction in the best corrected acuity, is it worth bringing the patient back for a shorter recall? So instead of bringing them back at 12 months or 2 years, perhaps halving that?
Yeah, that's reasonable based on the other findings that you may have picked up or the level of your suspicion.
So you mentioned doing ret over their spectacles. Using the specs is actually quite a good starting point because you haven't got as many lenses in the trial frame to begin with, so the reflex is brighter.
Yeah, so this is just an initial check to guide me as to whether from the history my suspicion is right or not. And then I'd put the whole refraction into the trial frame and do a full ret. And quite often you'll see a scissor reflex. That's one of the things that you get in keratoconus.
So I think all of us are very familiar with the normal reflex, but could you just explain what the scissor reflex looks like?
Yeah, the scissor reflex, you would quite often see it as you get close to the endpoint, even though there's not really a true endpoint in keratoconus because it depends on where on the cornea you're doing your retinoscopy. As you swipe across, you'll have one part of the beam going in the same direction as your swipe, and you'll also at the same time get a part of the beam appearing to go in the opposite direction.
Yes. So it literally is looking at the reflex and then seeing it actually split. So one half goes one way and one half goes the other way.
Yeah.
If you do suspect keratoconus, is it worth doing keratometry?
Yeah, keratometry is one of the things that most optometrists have access to. So I would say put them in the keratometer And if you see distorted myes, that again should be one of the things that allows you to get more suspicious, and it's useful information to put on the referral letter.
So if you do find that you've got a high degree of suspicion with keratoconus, how do you go about communicating your findings to the patient?
You'd make them aware that there are certain conditions that can cause refractive changes, and one of the likely causes in their case, depending on the degree of suspicion, you'd word it accordingly. But if you're very suspicious and you're almost confident, then you can describe it to them. So I direct them to the websites that I am happy for them to look at in the run-up to their referral and their appointment at the hospital.
So before they go to the hospital, they're already quite well informed, and that means they can ask the relevant questions when they get there.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons for that is so if they do end up having a confirmed diagnosis at the hospital and they're being offered treatment, at that point, they don't delay saying, oh, I want to think about it. I wasn't expecting it. So then they can make the decision quickly and promptly and get listed for whatever treatment is being offered to them. We know these people, especially if they're young, they progress very quickly and they could end up with a worse outcome due to the delay.
So in your area, what is the referral pathway and what treatment are they likely to have access to?
In my area, we have a dedicated keratoconus screening clinic, which is an optometrist-led clinic in the hospital, and they will have a battery of tests. And one of those is the topography. So corneal topography will be used to determine whether this patient is keratoconic or not. Once they have had confirmed diagnosis, they're then considered for cross-linking treatment. And cross-linking is offered as early as possible. In patients under 18, it's offered at diagnosis. Anyone over 18, then we look for evidence of progression. And as soon as we see that, we offer them the cross-linking procedure.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists, and that's where we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover, or better still, if you have a fascinating case you want to share, email podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. I'm now joined by Mr. Damien Lake, consultant ophthalmologist and surgeon at East Grinstead Hospital. Damien, can you start by telling us how common keratoconus is?
It depends on the definition, really, and that's the difficulty. If you take a strict criteria, you could even put the case that it's as common as 1 in 1,000 in the population. It certainly has increased incidence in certain racial groups, like from the Middle East, and in certain other disease groups such as eczema or people who rub their eyes and allergic diseases. But it's a lot more common than we often realise because the tools to select the cases from the population are not available generally in practice.
So the patient we heard from in the case study was a fairly young man, and he was only in his mid to late teens when he was diagnosed, and he also had significant visual symptoms. Would you say that's fairly typical?
It's fairly typical of the cases that we find selected because they get to that stage before it's suspected. So he probably would have had clinical manifestations of keratoconus much earlier on, but all of those symptoms that he is describing are fairly later onset manifestations of the disease process. And that's the problem.
Right. So in routine practice, normally when we're seeing children on a regular basis, we are looking for progressive astigmatic change. We're looking for unusual retinoscopy reflexes. And then that's also followed on by a decreased visual acuity as well. And then if we are very suspicious, we could do keratometry. So we could see some corneal distortion in the myers. And that's what we discussed with you here. Is there any other diagnostic tests that you think would be helpful to help identify positive early signs?
Yes, I think that all of those are worthy things to do, but really all of those signs are manifestations of irregular astigmatism, at which case the disease progress is quite advanced. We absolutely must have corneal topography in all optometric practices. You just will not pick it up with clinical signs early enough. You're only going to get moderate to severe keratoconus. With corneal topography, you will get the early cases. And really, it's the only way that you're going to do that.
Right. So it could be that if topography technology was harnessed in regular practice, we'd pick up early signs much sooner because we could basically screen for it on a regular basis quite easily. Bearing in mind that most practices don't have topographers, what other alternatives are there for trying to pick up keratoconus early?
Keratoconus is often starting in childhood, before the age of 10 even in some cases. It's at higher risk in Asian populations and in populations that are rubbing their eyes and have allergic diseases and have asthma and eczema. You're looking for an increase in astigmatism over time. And in those groups in which they start off with a higher astigmatism, I mean, there's a certain rate of astigmatism in the population. So something like a third of people have got one diopter. So anything above that in a younger age group that's increasing should maybe alert you to the possibility that they might have keratoconus, particularly if it's asymmetric. It's quite common to find one eye that's much worse than the other eye. That again should be a light bulb moment, perhaps.
So I'm just thinking, if I were to see a child in practice, but I suppose if even at first presentation, if they've got that positive family history, if I see a cell of more than one diopter and it's asymmetrical, I'd probably bring them back for a sooner recall to establish whether or not there is any evidence of astigmatic progression. And if there is, it raises the index of suspicions more, and then it's worth perhaps following that up with a routine referral. Is that a way forward if we don't have a topographer?
It is a way forward. Again, there is the myth of the genetics. I mean, genetics is out there. I'm not saying that it's not a genetic disease. It is a genetic disease. And there are distinct family groups in which you see it generation after generation. I treat many families who I'm treating the grandchildren, children, and the primary index case. But that's notable for its relative rarity. I mean, most people that I see do not have family members who have keratoconus, or do not have direct family members that have keratoconus. So looking for that is not a good discriminator, in my opinion. And that's the problem with keratoconus.
So what proportion of your patients would you say are still diagnosed quite late?
Next to all of them. I mean, there's a small percentage. Less than 5% might be picked up by a really good optometrist, usually with a topographer. And that's the key, in my opinion. I know that you'd like me to give some signs that optometrists can pick up and send in the cases, but to be honest, it's not out there. If it had been clinical signs which were going to separate out early keratoconics from non-keratoconics, then we would have done that 50 years ago. I'm afraid it's technology, and an investment in even a basic topographer will do.
Yeah. So we're not going to change people's equipment status overnight, but from a screening point of view, is it worth capturing baseline keratometry in your young patients that come in for their eye test? So even if you just take a baseline K reading, I know we're looking at only the central portion of the cornea when you use a typical keratometer. If we look at baseline keratometry, record those K readings, make a note of whether the myas are circular or just the absence of distortion. And then if we do it at a later stage, at least then perhaps that's another way of screening if we don't have topographers.
I think in the absence of topography, it's the second best option, but you will pick up moderates before they get to severe, rather than early before they get to moderates. And I'm often surprised how their vision is preserved despite quite large changes in the peripheral keratometry. And it's because keratoconus people, it's happened slowly over time. They're children, so they're tolerant of changes in their visual quality, and they adapt to it. If you look at their wavefront scan, so the aberrations that their cornea is producing, it's awful. But what you'll see if you try and measure vision in keratoconus people, they're very tolerant of that aberration and they use it. You'll see them screw their eyes up. They're using the pinhole effect. You'll see them tilt their head to get a good vision.
And they've had time to adapt, haven't they? Their neuroadaptation allows them to adapt and guesstimate what they should be seeing. And quite often they're quite accurate.
Yeah, and it's happened very slowly, usually from when they were in primary school onwards. And so at the age of 9 or 10, they've not been able to go, you know, Mum, I think I've got keratoconus. I'm not seeing as I should do, because they've got nothing to benchmark against. So they just accept that vision isn't perfect and they use it. And it gets gradually worse as time goes on until somebody says, oh, you're 18 and you're not seeing very well. Why is that?
When you do see a patient that does need to be referred, how quickly should they be seen in an ideal situation?
In an ideal situation, as soon as possible. But in peacetime in the health service, it usually would have been within 18 weeks. At the present time, who knows? I mean, there's great stresses at the moment.
And if a patient is delayed, as they would be currently due to the COVID backlog, is there any advice that the optometrist can give the patient or anything they can do for the patient in the meantime while they're awaiting referral?
Yes, I think that keratoconus is a disease where the cornea is soft. Number one, don't rub the eye. And if they've got ocular surface inflammation from allergy, from hay fever symptoms, etc., treat that so that decreases the inflammatory condition. And that's as much as we can do, really.
Is it appropriate to prescribe or to fit them with RGP lenses at this point in time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't do that. For me, that's fine. RGPs or hybrids are a good way forward. We need to make these kids functional because often it's affecting their school life. They're not achieving as they would be otherwise.
RGP is a dying art, as is retinoscopy in some people's view. But with RGP fitting, a lot of optometrists wouldn't necessarily go to fit a bitoric or a back surface toric. So therefore, if they're trying to fit a spherical RGP onto a mildly keratoconic eye, let's say, and they can't achieve an alignment fit, so there is a potential for that cornea to be slightly warped by the RGP over a period of time. Is that going to interfere with their hospital diagnostics when they do eventually get there?
No, they're usually advised not to wear the contact lenses for a week or two prior to the hospital appointment. So it shouldn't do. And usually if they're severe enough that they've warranted RGP usage, then even with the RGP taken off, there should be clinical signs of keratoconus or topographic signs of keratoconus.
So cross-linking has gradually become more widely available. For those of us that don't know much about cross-linking, how does it actually work?
Well, I mean, collagen cross-linking is the only treatment which will prevent progression. So it doesn't improve vision generally, but it is used to treat progression. And the cost utility of collagen cross-linking, saving a young patient a lifetime of health service appointments and or cornea grafts and the management of cornea grafts, is just amazing. We usually put a few drops of local anaesthetic and the surface epithelium is debrided, and then the patient undergoes saturation with riboflavin, which is a B vitamin. Riboflavin soaks into the stroma, and after the stroma is completely saturated, which usually takes about 30 minutes, the patient is then lying down. There's a speculum to keep the lids open, and the patient looks straight ahead at an ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light activates the riboflavin. Free radicals are created in the stroma, which cause a chemical cross-linking of the collagens in the corneal stroma. And that increases the tensile strength of the stroma and will prevent progression of the keratoconus in future. So all the patients are warned, you know, it's very painful for 3 or 4 days afterwards. Even if you put a bandage contact lens in, we usually give patients a drop of proximethicone to take for when it gets unbearable, but it's not a very pleasant procedure post-operatively.
How widely is cross-linking available across the UK now?
Yeah, it'll depend in which local area you are as to whether you can access it easily or not.
But if you can't access it locally, but you have seen a ophthalmologist in your local hospital who's confirmed a diagnosis of keratoconus, can those patients access cross-linking privately?
Oh, of course. There are many private facilities to have collagen cross-linking. It's still a fairly expensive procedure. It will vary between about £1,000 and £2,000.
So it may well be available in your local area, even if your local hospital doesn't have it. So I think it's certainly something that patients should be made aware that it may exist and that it's an option for them to go and investigate and research, because someone may be prepared to pay those costs. So you mentioned that most of your patients are referred with quite advanced stages of keratoconus, and where cross-linking isn't the right option for them, what other options are available for those patients?
Those patients that can't have it are those that are already too steep or too thin. So if you've got poor vision, the first step is to try a contact lens. If you're not tolerant of the contact lens, then you may require either an intracorneal ring, which is a small segment of acrylate plastic in a segment which can be implanted in the cornea and is really used to treat irregular astigmatism or to try and flatten very steep corneas. And if you've got scarring and steepening poor vision, can't tolerate a contact lens, then really you're looking at a cornea graft in that situation.
Mm. So Damien, do you have any final message for optometrists in practice out there? I suspect I know what that is, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Yeah, you do know what it is. It's to buy a simple corneal topography, get an autorefractor with a simple corneal topography map on it, preferably with a keratoconus screener on it, which you can get quite cheaply nowadays. I bought one myself. It doesn't cost much more than an autorefractor. You don't even have to know very much about corneal topography. You just need to follow what the screener says. And if it says you've got a moderate high risk that this is keratoconus, you can refer onwards. Once in a while, you'll save a young patient from a life of real big problems and you'll improve their life. And that's got to be the aim of it all, really.
Absolutely. Thank you, Damien.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. If you would like more information about dealing with keratoconus, go to our website, docit.info, and search for Sound Optometry to find the additional reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website will gain one CET point covering communication, ocular disease, and assessment of visual function. Next time, we'll be discussing myopia management with soft contact lenses. We'd really appreciate it if you spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen, or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. I'm Michelle Hanratty, and the producers are Dr. Hilary Guite and Jason Hoskin. Thanks for listening.